So it is a little bit unusual today because we're actually teaching out of the church calendar, which we don't often do here. Like Ted was saying, it is Christ the King Sunday. And so we're kind of looking at that theme. We've been talking about uncertainty for a while. And so this is kind of a good way to wrap up that whole discussion, because one of the reasons that this Sunday was even started and added to the liturgical calendar was because the church was facing a lot of uncertainty. So it started way back in 1925, which is not that long ago. It's actually a pretty recent addition to the church year. It was started by this happy-looking guy, Pope Pius XI. Honestly, this was the smiliest picture I could find of him. I looked really hard. In fact, in one of the pictures, he looked like he was trying to smile. And it's like when a serial killer tries to smile and they can't do it. That's what it looked like. It was very bad. So I'm sure he was a lovely person, but not photogenic. But anyway, it was in 1925 that he added this to the church calendar. And the reason that he did was the Catholic Church at that time was facing a lot of struggle across the world. So the respect for the church as a whole was waning. People were not listening to them. They were losing their influence. There was a lot more antagonism between governments and the church. So that was difficult. And he was really trying in a way to remind people of who was in charge. So he was kind of just basically flipping off all the world leaders on behalf of the church and saying, hey, look, we're still more powerful than you. So he wrote about why he was starting and why he added this to the church calendar. And he had several goals. One was that he wanted to show the nations that the church has the right to freedom and immunity from any state government. He wanted to show the world leaders that they should respect Jesus, and he wanted to encourage Christians that Christ should reign in their hearts and minds and wills and bodies. So he's trying to accomplish all those things with this Sunday. Now, once the Catholic Church started it, other churches also adopted this. So like Ted, I grew up Lutheran, and so we also had Christ the King Sunday. But it's interesting to see how different denominations have taken this idea and adjusted a little bit. So in some churches, in the Uniting Church of Australia, they call it the Reign of Christ Sunday because they don't want to really talk about king. That idea of a king can be kind of difficult, either because it's so predominantly male, obviously, or just the idea that authority is a struggle. We here at Imago, we love authority, so we totally embrace the whole king idea. It's not really a problem for us, but, some people, that was a little bit of an issue. So they just changed the wording a little bit. In the Church of Wales, the Anglican Church of Wales, they actually took the idea and they're the overachievers. So they actually do 4 Sundays before Advent, and they're all the Sundays of the kingdom. And so they focus on different aspects of the kingdom as they go through, which is an interesting way to approach it. So one of my favorites, though, is the Evangelical Lutheran Church of Sweden. They have a whole different name for it. They actually call it the Sunday of Doom, which is like the best name ever. So those of you who are like, oh, good, Brian's preaching, we're going to have stupid pop culture references, and he's going to cry a lot. I resent your stereotype, but you're absolutely right. That's what we're going to have. So just know that's where we're going today. So, yeah. So again, they focus on the end times and the final judgments and really emphasize that, which to me cracks me up because, again, I grew up Lutheran, and we would rather drink coffee with sugar and cream in it than talk about the end times. Like, we just do not do that. We are super polite, nice people in Lutheran church. So anyway, they apparently have embraced that in Sweden and make a big deal about that. So they keep the focus. It still fits with the theme if you're trying to emphasize the power of Christ. I can see how you would work that in. But again, it's a little different focus than what we're going to talk about today. So we're going to be kind of talking about why do we care about Christ the King Sunday. And as I was thinking about this week, one of the things that just struck me over and over again is how we really do want to follow a good leader. Again, we kind of joke about our anti-authoritarian ways here at Imago, but even we, there's something that's wired into us to want to have a good leader that we can trust and follow. And so that comes up lots of ways. Like every election cycle, we have hope that this person would change if we can get them into office, that maybe if this group could have come to power, things would be different. We watch TV shows like Undercover Boss, and we really hope that these CEOs are super nice guys who would give us vacation money and college funds if they just got to know us. We look at sports heroes. We want to be just like them. I don't have any examples of that personally, but I'm sure some of you have sports heroes that you want to be just like. So that's good. And we even want to make our pastors be perfect. We want them to have big plans for the church, to do all the hardest jobs, to have the answers to all our questions. We want them to be a model of our church out there in the world. And most pastors do some of those things. Few pastors can do all of those things. But those are the goals that we put on them. Even in our fictional stories, and that's where we see it the most, because in our fiction, that's where the desires of our heart really come out, and you can see what we're really hoping for. But we see that a lot. We want our kings to be strong, like Black Panther. We want our rulers to be wise, like Galadriel. We want them to have all the answers. We want them to be noble, like King Arthur, and possibly have a coconut horse, whichever. We want our leaders to be tough, to know that they're going to do the right thing when it's hard. And we want our leaders to be principled. We want them to do things for the right reasons, even when it's hard, even when they have to go through lots of difficulty and struggle and conflict to get to the things. We want them to do those things because they are trying to do what's best for everyone. There's actually so much in fiction, this idea of the good leader, that there's a trope for it. There's a website called TV Tropes, and they take all the different plot lines of all the shows, and they look at the things that show up again and again and again. And one that shows up again and again is the good ruler. And when you listen to the description of the good ruler, it's what we long for. I just feel my heart being pulled to that when I read it. So here's what it said on the website. The good ruler is honorable, virtuous, wise, and understanding. She cares about her subjects no matter how seemingly unimportant they are and puts their well-being above her own. He governs the land fairly. He's a royal who actually does something and is often very modest about his own rank and position. He also tends to be soft-spoken, but when a good king raises his voice, you'd better listen. Remember that good does not always equal soft. If the story takes place during war, you can expect her to be on the front lines, always putting the soldiers first. Above all else, a good ruler cares about her kingdom and her people and will sacrifice herself to protect them, even if that means putting honor before reason. Again, those are the kinds of rulers that we want. That's something that we are just wired to look for. We often want a ruler like what we see in Psalm 72. Here's what it says. It says, "Give the gift of wise rule to the king, O God, the gift of just rule to the crown prince. May he judge your people rightly, be honorable to your meek and lowly. Let the mountains give exuberant witness. Shape the hills with the contours of right living. Please stand up for the poor and help the children of the needy. Come down hard on cruel tyrants. Outlast the sun, outlive the moon, age after age after age. Be rainfall on cut grass and earth-refreshing rain showers. Let righteousness burst into blossom and peace abound until the moon fades to nothing. Rule from sea to sea and from river to rim. Foes will fall on their knees before God. His enemies lick the dust. Kings remote and legendary will pay homage. Kings rich and resplendent will turn over their wealth. And all kings will fall down and worship, and godless nations will sign up to serve him. Because he rescues the poor at the first sign of need, the destitute who have run out of luck. He opens a place in his heart for the down and out, and he restores the wretched of the earth. He frees them from tyranny and torture. When they bleed, he bleeds. When they die, he dies." Now, the psalm continues along with that idea, and it gets a little bit wonky after that, because then he starts asking for the king to be covered in gold and have great honor and riches, and it's a little awkward because King Solomon is the one who's writing this psalm, so he's kind of writing about himself, so it does a little bit weird circle back thing that's a little bit strange. But again, we can hear that message again. This is the kind of king that we want. And I love how over and over again it talks about reaching out for the poor and lifting up the oppressed. He is powerful, and other nations are coming under his control, but he's using that for good among his own people. And that's something that resonates with me. The trick comes when we have to compare fictional rulers with real-life rulers. Real leaders are real people, which means that they are flawed and will all mess up. Each one of us can think of countless times when we've been let down by a leader, someone who's in authority over us. And we can also think of times when we were in charge of something, maybe a group project or a huge project at work, or an organization that we were trying to lead, and then we made mistakes that hurt other people. The people of Israel had the same struggle. They went for years without a king, and they finally were begging for one. They'd never had one before. They were just following God and God's prophets. But finally, they decided they really wanted a king, someone who could rule them in real life. So they demanded that Samuel give them a king, and so he talked to God, and then he brought this warning down. So God sent Samuel down to tell people, here's what's going to happen if you get what you say you want. So Samuel said, "This is the way the kind of king you're talking about operates. He'll take your sons and make soldiers of them, chariotry, cavalry, infantry, regimented into battalions and squadrons. He'll put some to forced labor on his farms, plowing and harvesting, and others to make either weapons of war or chariots in which he can ride in luxury. He'll put your daughters to work as beaticians and waitresses and cooks." It's the message, obviously. "He'll conscript your best fields, vineyards, and orchards and hand them over to his special friends. He'll tax your harvest and vintage to support his extensive bureaucracy. Your prized workers and best animals he'll take for his own use. He'll lay a tax on your flocks and you'll end up no better than slaves." Now, it's easy for us to judge Israel now, looking back, thinking, why would you want a king? You had God right there. He's speaking to you directly all the time. Why would you want that? But you have to remember what was going on in the life of the people of Israel at that time. They were surrounded by nations who wanted to destroy them. They were constantly trying to destroy them. And every one of those nations had a strong, powerful king leading the charge, leading his people into battle against them. They saw time and time again how effective a strong king could be. And also, Samuel's getting all bent out of shape, but part of the problem was his two sons were the ones that were supposed to be in charge of Israel. He had turned that over. He kind of retired. And so his two sons, Joel and Abijah, were supposed to be the ones ruling Israel, but they were corrupt. They kept taking bribes. They were neglecting the ways of God. The people of Israel looked to Samuel's sons, who were supposed to be taking care of them, supposed to be protecting them, and they were just taking care of themselves. So they wanted something different. Again, it's easy to judge them, but really, we do the same thing. We want someone to come in and protect us and take care of us. And we see some injustice, we speak up. So the idea was they wanted a king and they got one, but it wasn't exactly what they were hoping for. I've often wished, especially election time, that when I would go in to vote, I could look at the ballot and God would just make the ones light up that I should vote for. Again, he never does that, ever. But there were times in the Bible where he actually said, "That's my guy. That's the one I want to be king." And even when he did that, it didn't work out so well. King Saul was one of the first kings that was appointed directly by God. And I thought it was interesting. His name, Saul, means asked for or prayed for. He was the answer to the prayers of the people. But he was known for a lot of things, like tossing spears at David, asking for a bride price of 100 foreskins, ordering the death of an entire village because their high priest had helped David when he was chasing him down. He consulted a medium after outlawing witchcraft himself to figure out his future. And when things got rough in the final battle, he fell on his own sword because his slave wouldn't kill him. Didn't work out really well as a king. Next was King David, whose name means beloved. It was funny looking for artwork about David. Apparently all he did was harp. Every picture of him has him harping all the time. It was his favorite hobby, apparently. But we all know his story, right? The man after God's own heart who also wanted Bathsheba and made sure that he got her, killed her husband, was in battle with his own son, time and time again chose himself over the people that he's supposed to be serving. And then his son Solomon, whose name is related to man of peace. Again, for all the resources and riches that God gave him, all the wisdom, all the things that were showered on him, he's known for idolatry, marrying many, 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 many foreign women, basking in his riches, and ultimately turning from God. We want leaders who will be the good ruler here on earth. There are many leaders who are good, who genuinely want to serve their people, who try to do what's best, but like all of us, they're human, and we can't put our trust in them alone. They just can't be Jesus. We don't just put our trust in leaders either. We find lots of things to make our own personal king to protect and save us. It could be our money. It could be career success. It could be a romantic relationship or a family relationship. It could have even this right set of beliefs. It could be respect from our peers, people around us. If you look at the Enneagram, pretty much you look at the dark side of any number on the Enneagram, it's you making a king to protect you from the world. It's easy to draw those little diagrams where you put a little throne in the center and you draw a little stick figure Jesus on there and say he's supposed to be in the spot. I did that a lot in college. My friends and family really loved it. Super popular. But even when I was using that diagram and saying those words, I didn't always understand what it meant. I didn't know how to make him actually be the king of my life. And I'm still not sure sometimes. But what I do now is I look at Jesus and I look at what he said. And I look at who he said it to. And I look at how he treated people. And I try to copy that part of who he was as king. It's a challenge because he doesn't really act like other leaders. He doesn't act like the people I see every day. He just does things very, very differently. He's definitely a very different kind of king. Now, this Sunday was meant to keep the world leaders in their place, to remind them that Jesus was the one really in charge and they were all subject to him. And someday that will actually be true. On earth, we'll see that physically happening. But right now, Jesus is told a very different way to be a king, a very different way to operate. So in Mark 10, 42 to 45, this is a passage that we've heard a lot. This is right after the James and John were asking if they could be up on his right left throne in the heaven. We heard that passage a couple weeks ago in the lectionary. And so that caused a little grumbling with the disciples. And Jesus brought a new idea to them. When the other 10 had heard this conversation, they lost their tempers with James and John, and Jesus got them together to settle things down. "You've observed how godless rulers throw their weight around," he said. "And when people get a little power, how quickly it goes to their head. It's not going to be that way with you. Whoever wants to be great must become a servant, and whoever wants to be first among you must be your slave. That's what the Son of Man has done. He came to serve, not to be served, and then to give away his life in exchange for many who are held hostage." And it wasn't the kind of king that the disciples or the nation of Israel were hoping for. It's not the kind of king that we hope for most of the time. We want King T'Challa. We want Princess Leia. We want someone who'll come in and make sure that we're okay. We want leaders who are good and visibly with us and powerful. We want to be protected. It's interesting, when I was looking in the Gospels, most of the references to Jesus as a king happen during the Passion story. They don't happen when he's performing miracles and dazzling the teachers with his wisdom. It's coming when he's the most broken, when he's the least kingly in the eyes of the world. When Pilate asks Jesus if he's the king of the Jews, in the first three Gospels, he just says variations of, "Well, if you say so." In John, the passage that we heard today, he answers differently. John includes these words: "My kingdom," said Jesus, "doesn't consist of what you see around you. If it did, my followers would fight so that I wouldn't be handed over to the Jews. But I'm not that kind of king. I'm not the world's kind of king." Now, I have to admit, when I heard this passage, all I could think of was a family story. So when my cousin Elizabeth was about 7, she was in our Christmas program at church, and she was playing Mary. And she was great because she's super sassy. And so she was, after the play was over, my brother was telling her what a good job she did, and she was just kind of giving him some attitude back. And he said, "Well, Elizabeth, Mary's supposed to be sweet and kind and nice, and you were not being those." And she looked at him and said, "I'm not that kind of Mary." Now, that phrase has been burned into our family consciousness, and now all the time we still say, "I'm not that kind of Mary," all the time. And I can't help but hear Jesus being a little sassy, even though I know he wasn't. I still hear that voice. But if he's not the world's kind of king, and he won't guarantee prosperity, and he won't destroy our enemies, what good is he? Why would we even want to follow him in the first place? What difference does it make to have a king who doesn't promise to do those things that we want? Well, there's a couple things. Having a good king unites us. History has shown us again and again that following human leaders will always divide us. We see that happen on the world stage, in big pictures with nations, but we also see it in our own personal histories. We've seen families and friendships and churches split over human disagreement as people of a leader or a belief or an emotion walk out the door. Years ago, Laura and I were checking out a church in Morton, and we'd been going there for a few weeks, and out of the blue for us, we were, like I said, pretty new, the pastor left and set up shop across town the next Sunday, and 3/4 of the people went with him. So we'd come into this huge space, and suddenly everyone was gone. We hadn't experienced that before. We didn't know quite what to do. There wasn't a lot of talk of Jesus in that conversation. There was a lot of talk about the people involved and why people were going one way and going the other. Again, we didn't know all the issues that caused the split, but we could see the devastation that was left behind. I look at the disciples, and they were very, very different people. They had very different backgrounds. They probably would never have hung out together in any of their circumstances. Maybe if they had a Saturday detention and overcame their high school stereotypes and got to be best friends, maybe that. But otherwise, they wouldn't even talk to each other. But they all connected to Jesus. They loved him. They saw something in him, and so they would go anywhere with him and travel with him. He was what drew them together. He was a connection that held them there when anything else would have pushed them apart. If we focus on Jesus as our king more than our thoughts about Jesus, we can find common goals and we can serve together. It's been a part of Imago since the very beginning. Every time we have the Imago story class, that's one of the things that comes up again and again. Now, in Matthew 23, starting with verse 8, Jesus is talking about the religious leaders of his day. I've heard this passage lots of times, but when I read it this time, something new kind of stood out to me. It just says, "But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher, and you are all brothers. And do not call anyone on earth father, for you have one father, and he is in heaven. Nor are you to be called instructors, because you have one instructor, the Messiah. The greatest among you will be your servant. Those who exalt themselves will be humbled, and those who humble themselves will be exalted." There's that theme again. The line that stood out to me is, "You have one teacher, and you are all brothers." I just haven't noticed that line before. Now, I don't think that Jesus is saying that no one should teach and no one should lead. I don't think he's saying that. I don't think he's saying you can't call your father, father. But I do think he's reminding us that he is the one that we actually follow. And if we put too much importance on the people around us, we can lose sight of him. And we can miss out on what he's really saying to us. If we keep our focus on him, we're less likely to get caught up in all the ways that we're different from our sisters and our brothers. Now, there's a couple of passages, again, we hear a lot. In Ephesians 4, Paul's describing the diverse gifts of the church. He describes them as different parts of the body. He says what unifies them isn't one belief system, but the fact they're all connected to the head, which is Christ. Keeps all those pieces working together. And in 1 Corinthians 12, again, it's the body narrative. He talks about how all the different parts shouldn't be comparing themselves to each other and saying, well, I'm not an eye, I'm not a foot. But again, what connects us is that Christ is the whole body, all those pieces working together. He's what unifies us. Now, I have to be clear. This doesn't mean that we agree on everything, ever. It doesn't mean that we don't talk about what we think so that nobody around us is offended. It doesn't mean that at all. It means that we engage and we discuss and we share what we believe and we tell why and we push back and we listen to each other. Not because we want to get to the end where then they say, oh, you are so right. I can't believe I never noticed that before. Totally changed my mind. That only happens on Facebook, not in real life. But when we do that, we understand God a little differently. We see something about him that we didn't see before. Now, Laura and I came from a very conservative church before we came here. And there were so many things that we did not agree with them on. And we'd be in conversations and it would be so frustrating because it was a pretty big church and we were a really small part of that big church. And we just felt like our voice means nothing here. This is not making any difference. But it did, because as we talked to those people, again and again, I saw people who loved Jesus, absolutely loved him. And they were not acting out of selfishness. And they were not acting because they didn't care about people. And they were not even acting because they wanted to be right. They loved Jesus. And they were living in a way that honored that. And even though now I disagree with them on many, many things. And if we looked at actual issues, they would feel like I was on a different planet from them. But when I look at them, they are someone I still admire and respect. Because I know what drives their hearts. Because I talked to them and I could hear it. I could hear it in their words and I could see it in their actions. And I could see who they follow and who they love. And I love that same guy. So we can find things to do together because of that. It takes courage, though. It's hard to have those conversations. It's hard to speak up. It's hard to know that someone's going to completely disagree with you. But when you do that and push to the other side, I can't promise you it's going to be awesome. But I can't promise you that you will understand. And a lot of times, good things are going to come out of that. So I came across a quote from my very favorite Swiss theologian. I have lots of favorite Swiss theologians. He's maybe my second favorite. But this is by Hans Kuhn. This is what he said. Even the Protestant Christian does not believe in the Bible, but in the one to whom the Bible bears witness. Even the Orthodox Christian does not believe in tradition, but in the one whom tradition hands down. I love that phrase, the one whom tradition hands down. Even the Catholic Christian does not believe in the church, but in the one whom the church proclaims. Following Christ our King really does take precedence over everything else. And all those are tools to bring us to him, to help us understand him better. There's another thing called Stir Up Sunday. So it's a little interesting thing. It's the same Sunday. It's Christ the King Sunday in the church in England. And they started Stir Up Sunday because if you're going to make Christmas pudding, which is what that delicious looking thing is, you make it 5 weeks ahead so we can soak up lots and lots of alcohol before Christmas. It's delightful. So they would have this thing. So it's, again, 5 weeks before Christmas. They would stir it up. They have all these traditions to reinforce the meaning of Christmas. So, for example, that the pudding usually has 13 ingredients. So for the 12 disciples and for Jesus, they would all take turns stirring it. And you stir it from east to west to reenact the journey of the wise men. I'm not sure how you make sure you present yourself so you're stirring that way. I don't know. But that's what they do. They all get to make a wish when they're stirring. They do all these things. And so they call it Stir Up Sunday. But it has another reason why it's being called the Stir Up Sunday. It's also being called that because of what the prayer from the Book of Worship for that day talks about. In this Book of Common Prayer for that Sunday, it starts off with, Stir up, we beseech thee, O Lord, the wills of thy faithful people. The stirring up part is also God stirring us up, challenging us to do good things. And that's the other reason why we follow Christ as our King. He stirs us up. He calls us to greater challenges. Big shock. As I was thinking about kings, the Lord of the Rings came up to me a lot. I couldn't help but think about Aragorn's speech at the Black Gate. So those of you who have never seen it, I'm really sorry. Hang on. What's happening is basically he's going against a huge, overpowering evil that he has no hope of winning against. He's got a small army facing huge odds, and they're going to die. But their hope is that while he's doing that, in another part of the world, Frodo can destroy the ring, and evil will not conquer everything. So even though in this moment, there's no reason to think he's going to make it through this battle, they're going to fight. And so his job as the king is to rally the people to go into this fight, to not be afraid, to take this chance, to do something good, even though for them personally, it's not going to work out very well. And so he gives a speech. And as I was looking for it, this speech shows up so many places online, including lots of places that study rhetoric. It's an example of a really inspiring speech that they have students actually look at. So it's real short. We're going to listen to just what he says to the people in their, as they're facing that situation. So hopefully this will work. I also found there's a really awesome picture where they scan across the soldiers' faces, and there's one guy who's just like, oh no. And I thought that would be me. I'd be like, I'll just be over here while you go do that big thing. What I love about this speech is that he honors the fear that they have, and he acknowledges that he's afraid too, but he doesn't let them stop him. He reminds them of the good thing that they're doing, but he doesn't pretend that it's going to all work out well and be perfect. And he's right there with them. He's not sitting on a throne two kingdoms away saying, go do that thing. I hope it works out for you. He's at the front lines. He's charging ahead of them into this really hard battle. And that makes all the difference. That's what Jesus does with us. He goes before us. He came to earth to face all the fears and hurt and tragedy that we are going to face. And he's already in all those places that we fear the most. He's sitting in that room where the cancer medicine is waiting. He's on that corner where someone is hungry and scared. He's already at that table where that really painful conversation is going to have to take place. He's standing right next to our enemy as we struggle to find the strength to love them. He's in all those places that we fear the most. He's our king, and he rides before us. And he calls us his sisters and his brothers. Now, there have been a lot of times this last week and this last month, this last year, that I didn't think I'd keep going. Things were too hard. Obstacles were too great. I just didn't have the strength to keep going. Even getting ready for this message, I couldn't help but think about Glennon Doyle. She writes the Momastery blog, if you've ever read her work. She's very funny. But she talked about she had to go back to her college and do an alumni speech. And they wanted her to be all inspiring and talk about her success. And she was crippled with depression. Didn't think she could do it. And so she just pulled on her very favorite hoodie and wrapped it around her as tight as she could. And she went out in front of all those people and she just sat down in the front of the stage and kind of just clutched her microphone and she just barreled through it. And honestly, I almost wore my hoodie today. Girl here on the front pew. But in all those times, I didn't see Jesus on a horse waving a sword, riding around. But I did see him going before me into those hard situations. He was there already loving people who were hard to love, saying words that were difficult to hear. And he was moving into yet another situation that seemed hopeless and still brought hope. Now, I wish I could say I followed him perfectly, but if you know me at all, you know that is not the case. Honestly, I didn't even think to look for him in a lot of those situations. I just gritted my teeth and charged in and hoped that it would all work out. But when each storm had passed, and I was either nursing my wounds or just resting gratefully in just a moment of peace afterwards, I saw him. I saw his fingerprints on everything that had happened and realized that that was what was going on. And I also saw him in all of you. I saw him in your kind words when things looked really black. I saw him in your jokes that made me laugh when I desperately needed to laugh. I saw him in your difficult questions that made me think. I saw him in your example of love and grace time and time again. I saw my king reflected in you. And that was enough to get through that storm. So for each of us, we have to look and see, what is the call of the good king for you, for me, for each of us? What is that hard thing that he is calling you into? It doesn't have to be big. It doesn't have to be monumental. It doesn't have to be going to Africa. I was always sure I had to go to Africa when I was a kid. I thought that's what all God called you to do. I think if you're Sue and Lewis, that does mean that's what happens. You do go to Africa. But I think for most of us, there are places right by us that he's calling us into. Things that we're still scared of. Things that still hurt. But things where he already is, and he's waiting for us to go. So we're just going to take a moment of quiet just for you to listen to the call of God. And I'm not going to pretend for 1 second to know what that is for you. But I do know that he is with you in that. And he loves you in that purpose. So we're just going to take a moment and be quiet and let him speak. So maybe something came to you now. Maybe something will come to you tomorrow or the day after. But I really want to encourage you to keep listening for that call. Keep watching for those places where he's already there and is calling you to join him. I want to end today with a poem. It's called Sonnet for the Reign of Christ. It's by Andrew King, which I just thought was a funny coincidence. But he talks about Christ as our king. And I have to confess, he wrote it as a sonnet because he was trying to make it match the rhyming pattern of a sonnet. And it's terrible if you read it that way. So I'm just going to read it as a free verse. So just know it's not going to follow the sonnet pattern. You, upon your throne of self-giving love set upon a garbage heap, that tower of wood where on a dark day you are shoved to be rid of you by the world's powers. You who called the blind to new ways of sight and freed from their chains the captives to fear and despair. Who, with love's strength and fresh light, called the lost from graves, yet commanding here no armies, holding here no sword, allow yourself to suffer death for others. Your rule is surely not of this world, but how surely it is our need. Show us the door to true peace, O Christ. Rule our hearts, your voice our one guide, your way of love our one choice. My prayer is that will be true for all of us as we follow him.